Welcome to Real Money with David Holland, the show that focuses on real people, real problems, and real solutions. Unlike a lot of radio and TV personalities, David is a certified financial planner with over 20 years of financial experience. And because he actually provides advice to clients on a daily basis, our hyperactive compliance department wants us to tell you that David Holland is an investment advisor representative of Holland Advisory Services, a registered investment advisory firm. He also offers insurance and annuity products through Holland Insurance Services. Holland Advisory Services and Holland Insurance Services are separate affiliated companies that share common ownership under Holland Financial. Commentary given during this radio program is usually pretty smart, but should not be considered investment, insurance, tax, or legal advice. Views expressed concerning specific securities should not be considered an offer to buy or sell. Investment advice and financial planning services can only be given after an analysis of an individual's situation, only if you hire David and his firm to help you, and only available where Holland Advisory Services is registered or exempt from registering. And now, brace yourself. Ladies and gentlemen, here comes the unfiltered truth about money, investing, and retirement planning from a man who will give it to you straight. No bias and no spin. Here he is, David Holland.
Unfiltered like a pack of camels, Scott.
But more healthy.
You betcha. Oh, I've been looking forward to sitting down and talking with Scott Connor. Let him have it, Lisa.
The fastest 5 minutes in finance with Scott Connor.
Well, you know, if you just pulled up your television at the very end of the day on Wednesday's trade, you'd think it was a boring day.
I felt seasick.
It was some day.
I mean, it was just, I checked, and at one point, what was it down? The Dow was down over 170?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, futures weren't too bad. When I got up in the morning, they were, you know, just moderately soft. And after the market opened, particularly going into the European close, things got weaker and weaker and weaker. But a really nice late rally, either short covering or computer triggers. Dow ended up down 7 points. It really fought to get back in the green. Couldn't quite do it. I think with another 10 minutes, it would have made it. 12,495. S&P was in the green, up 2 at 13,18. NASDAQ up 11 at 28,50. Commodities continue to suffer. Gold down another $16 at $15.60. Oil down $1.41 at $90.44, but traded in the 80s, the high 80s for a while on the day. So that was a little encouraging. Tens at 174. You know, we always talk about tens and how when money wants to come out of risk, it goes into U.S. treasuries, but more so it really goes into German treasuries, what they call the Bund. And the Bund, the 30-year Bund, not the 10, which we normally talk about for our treasuries, the 30-year Bund was actually inside of 2% this week.
Holy moly.
Now, they're AAA, so we're not AAA.
That drives Scott bonkers, ladies and gentlemen.
We're the same credit rating as Japan.
So that's what did we say it was? It was
like 240% debt to GDP, something
right.
like that.
Right.
But that's all right. Tens of two. And then I'm keeping you up to date because I know you're dying to take Tony on a trip to Europe. $1.26 on the euro.
I've even got that on my iPhone so I can check it, you know, by the minute. Yeah. $1.26. And when we went over to Italy a few years back, it was $1.70. That hurt.
Well, when we talk a little bit about what happens if Greece leaves the union, I'll tell you of some economists who are calling for that to get almost all the way back down to parity. Yeah, 115, 110. A couple of different economists are looking at that. So if you are planning a trip to Europe, the currency is definitely going to help as we continue to go forward. Looking at economic news on Wednesday's trade, really not much going on domestically speaking. New home sales up 3.3% to a seasonally adjusted 343,000 annual rate for April. So that's pretty good. Beat expectations pretty handily. We're really seeing, you know, 6 months ago we were seeing pretty consistent broad economic news. Jobs were getting better. GDP was getting better. Things have kind of stalled out on the broad economy. But the housing numbers are coming in better and better and better. Toll Brothers was higher on the day. They posted earnings that beat expectations pretty handily. So a lot of good news coming out of the housing market. But remember, we have talked about it being a really, really wide U recovery rather than a V recovery. So
I keep asking for a V and you keep giving me U.
Yeah, we're just not going to get a V, but at least we're starting to see, you know, some traveling along the bottom of that U. And then also in other corporate news, not a whole lot really going on. We're all the way out of earnings season, except for there's always somebody announcing earnings, but the real S&P earnings season is over. Dell Computers, plunged after they had disappointing forecasts for second quarter revenue. A lot of that is European spending, but boy, those shares have suffered so much over the last 10 years.
What happened? They just got, they had their heyday, and then new competitors came in and ate their lunch.
Yeah, remember, they were really up to speed.
I mean, everybody was buying Dells.
Well, they were really up to speed with the just-in-time inventory. Remember, the you know, when they needed a part, then it showed up, so they had good cost controls that way. But you know what I think really happened to them more than anything is just time passed them by. People want tablets now.
Yeah, I think that's part of it. I think also part of it is just that, you know, they kind of said, okay, here's, you know, they set the standard, and people said, okay, well, we're going to do this. And somebody came in with the latest technology and built on top of that. And it's not all that different than when we helped rebuild Japan.
Yeah.
And they had all the latest and greatest, and then they were eating our lunch in terms of competition because they had the latest technology.
Yeah. And also very, very hard to grow revenue when the price of your product due to competition and technology is just dropping year after year after year. How are you going to grow revenue that way?
No, you can't.
So more tough times. More tough times for Dell. Looking forward at the week, the remainder of the week. Jobless claims on Thursday, as always. Not really much else going on Friday. We'll see some consumer sentiment numbers and some food price outlooks, which are always important from the on the commodity standpoint. Affects things like Tyson Foods and restaurants and things like that. But economically speaking, not a whole lot going on, so everybody can focus on Facebook and Europe.
All right. Well, I have what we're going to do, ladies and gentlemen, is we're going to take a quick break and come back. I've asked Scott if he wouldn't mind, if he would do us the favor of staying for the entire program, and he is absolutely delighted.
I had nothing else to do.
But I'm going to treat Scott like a guest, which he is, and we're going to break down some other topics that I want to get into and just give you a little bit more detail on what's going on in the market and the economy. So stay tuned.
Have you noticed most of the financial literature available is either so specific it doesn't apply or too generic to answer even the most basic questions? This revelation inspired David Holland to write his first two books, Confessions of a Financial Planner, Secrets to a Secure Retirement, and How to Get Great Advice and Avoid Financial Scams. These how-to guides contain easily accessible information on a wide variety of topics concerning personal finances. An effortless weekend read. You'll find clarification on what a mutual fund is, how to choose the right financial professional, and much more. Call Holland Financial at 888-747-PLAN to request a free excerpt from David's first book, Secrets to a Secure Retirement. The number again is 888-747-7526. Or visit davidholland.com for more information on this innovative book series.
DavidHolland.com is a great place to visit. Stay a while. Check it out. It's good stuff.
You're showing your television show on there, right?
Yeah, man. We're just getting that latest technology. Lisa has been working diligently on redesigning our webpage, making it very user-friendly with the iPhones and the tablets you talk about. And, you know, we got it going on.
Terrific.
But, yeah, the TV show is on there, and people can look at that, and it's good stuff. So, all right. Well, speaking of technology and liking something, the thumbs up for Facebook. We've seen this be a roller coaster. Well, it's actually been kind of the roller coaster down. They closed at what for Wednesday? Just under $32 a share?
Yep, they were up. Hang on a second.
Up about 3%?
They were up about a dollar today, and I think closed at 32 flat.
Okay.
Yeah, 32 flat, up a dollar. Okay, now, the price-earnings ratio on Facebook is 102. At these prices. Now, this is, remember, we've sold off $6 from the IPO share, $10 from the first print, 102 on the price-to-earnings ratio. Google's price-to-earnings ratio, 19. Apple's price-to-earnings ratio, 14. So although we've come down quite a bit at $32 a share, you know, on traditional valuations, it still looks like there's a lot of premium in there, and not to mention that there's another big wave of shares coming in 90 days.
You got two of them, right? You got one at 90 and one at 180 days?
Yeah, no,
and then what that means is this is when people can actually, who are in like lockdown mode, who have shares and are not permitted by law to sell them until they get past these hurdles, right?
That's right.
So you've got a lot. So right now the pricing, there could be a lot more pressure on the pricing for Facebook.
A lot of supply. It's just supply and demand. There's a lot of supply coming.
Okay. So with the pricing, it's the price 100 times the expected earnings. There's a lot of air there. There's a lot of expectation with that price that Facebook is going to be able to be a lot more than it is, right?
Yeah, not to mention an expectation of shrinking prices, because what has happened, what really happened behind the scenes on this IPO was back in, you know, 4 or 5 weeks ago, there was this obscure little phrasing in some of the paperwork that they were filing with the SEC that said, we're having a problem. Basically, now we know. It said, we're having a problem with our revenue because people are going from using their Facebook page online to using their Facebook page on their phone. And the revenue streams are significantly different.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's like
because
dimes
of how much is on there.
Yeah, and yeah. It's like, and because of the pass through rate, the click through rate. So if you're using Facebook online, the ad revenue is, you know, quarters, whereas you go on the phone, it's pennies.
Okay.
So even though the usage is growing exponentially, the revenue is way down because people are using it on their phones now instead of their laptops, and they're expecting that trend to continue.
Would you buy Facebook at today's prices?
No way.
What price would you buy it at?
Well, I don't think I would buy it if they they continue to have shrinking revenue.
Okay.
And if they continue to show signs of what is questionable, in my estimation, questionable corporate guidance, I wouldn't buy it at any price.
You don't trust the numbers yet?
No, I don't trust the numbers. And I think that a lot of what happened to retail investors, I think it is primarily the underwriter's faults.
That was Morgan Stanley.
The lead underwriter.
Yeah.
But I do think that some of the executive management of Facebook was complicit and kind of helped them along.
Doesn't look good. So at $32 a share, is that where we are? Yeah, $32 a share, Wednesday's closing numbers, still overpriced.
Yeah, I don't think there's any question about it, especially at 102 PE. But, you know, keep in mind that what really happened to Facebook on the IPO was that, you know, when they start an IPO, they don't have to list in writing what the expectation is for revenues. They don't have to forecast revenues in writing. They go out on the roadshow, and the roadshow is Zuckerberg and his executive team, and they go to the Goldman Sachs of the world, they go to the hedge funds, they go to the pension funds, and they say, well, here's what we think our revenue is going to be, and based on this revenue, this is what we think the stock is going to be worth.
This is what we think we'll make, this is what the profit will be, this is what it's worth based on these multiples that we think are reasonable.
Right, so how much stock do you want? That's all, we're out here to find out how much stock you want. And then about halfway through the roadshow, they started to say, well, that revenue number that we've been telling people, thank goodness we didn't write it down, because now we're starting to think with this click-through thing on the mobile phones, it's not going to really be what we thought it was going to be.
So there's two big things that happened. One, they had that shift in revenue expectation. And then the other is that, what was it, like a week or two out, they jacked up the total number of shares that they were going to make available?
Well, then when they started to change the revenue forecast, This revenue forecast change was not announced to the public. It was announced in this roadshow, which you couldn't get into. And all of a sudden, the people in the roadshow started to say, whoa, wait a minute now. I don't know that I want to pay $32 a share, and I sure as heck don't want 50,000 shares. So maybe I'll take 10,000 shares at $28 a share. And the underwriters started to say, this is going to be bad for us. But what we do know is that everybody out there with a retail account wants Facebook. So let's launch more shares because we can find anybody to buy them. They're not going to be institutional people. They're going to be retail.
Everybody wanted
them. Yeah, and they don't know what the price is. They don't know about the revenue. They don't know how to value it. So just price it at 38.
So it's almost like, and maybe almost is not the right word, maybe it is, that they were going to run short on the, what I would call the insiders.
They were going to run short on demand.
Demand.
From the
and
insiders.
And so they jacked up the price and the number of shares that they would offer to make up for that.
Yeah, and here's an exact example of it. Based on surveys they were doing, institutional investors felt like they were willing to pay about $32 a share. Retail investors, based on surveys they were doing, were willing to pay about $40 a share. So all these institutional investors who had already bought it and had bought it at $20 a share or so, they know it's worth $32, but they know they have somebody out there
that wants it for $40.
That'll pay $40
and
or
so
even
they sold.
$38, so they sold. And that's where all that extra allotment came from.
Wow.
It was from Goldman Sachs, and it was from mutual funds that were in the venture cap phase.
Whew.
You like that?
What a tangled web we weave. Well,
the good news is FINRA's involved.
Yeah, that's good. I feel much more comfortable now. We're going to take a quick break, come back. Next can of worms we're going to open is we're going to talk a little bit about JP Morgan, get an update from Scott on that. Stay tuned.
Many people invest without ever knowing what they pay in investment fees. When was the last time you dropped your car off for service and told them to fix whatever they want without getting an estimate first? I'll bet never. Why treat your portfolio any different? Holland Financial is ready to help. Call 888-747-PLAN to schedule your free consultation or visit us at davidholland.com.
All right, welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. My guest on today's program is Mr. Scott Connor, CFA, CFP, CHFC, Chartered Financial Analyst.
Yeah.
certified financial planner and chartered financial consultant. You don't like the chartered financial consultant? That's a pretty tough test. It's 10 parts, man. Hey, I've got that one, so don't knock it down.
I don't think it was 10. I don't think it was 10 when I took it.
Okay, well, like postage stamp?
7, something like that.
All right, so let's use some of those brain cells. J.P. Morgan, anything new there? They had a $2 billion loss. Is it going to be more than that?
I think it'll be more than that.
This is on a bad trade.
Yeah, what has happened is J.P. Morgan cornered a market, okay? And so when they were cornering the market, they thought, well, this is terrific. We are controlling this market. But then the market moved against them, and they didn't control it. So now everybody that they trade against says, I know you have to sell that thing. I know there aren't many of us who are going to buy it. And I know you're J.P. Morgan. You've been pushing me around for the last couple of years. So I'll give you a couple of dimes on the dollar.
This is Duke and Duke from Trading Places, frozen orange juice.
It's very, very, very similar. Now, they were using very, very complicated derivatives, and they were doing derivatives of derivatives and layering derivatives on top of derivatives. But I will say this, though, to Jamie Dimon's credit, who I have always thought is one of the best CEOs, particularly in the financial services industry, he's been very candid. He hasn't really tried to, you know, say, well, this is nothing he did originally.
He's not doing a Corzine.
He's definitely not doing a Corzine. Originally, he said, this is a tempest in a teapot. But then he called a serious meeting, and he said, I want to see all these trades. And he said, holy smokes, we got a problem. Yeah. And he's been very clear with the financial press and saying, this is a self-inflicted wound. It's a terrible trade. It's not a risk-appropriate trade. And so they lost their
shouldn't happen. Yeah. I'll make sure it doesn't happen again.
Yeah. So they lost the CIO, the chief investment officer. This is stuff all based in London. And then they originally announced, well, the guy that's been placing all these trades that really we should have been watching, but we weren't watching him. And that's how we got away with placing all these trades. He's not really going to leave the firm quite yet. And the reason for that is because he's the only guy that knows how to unwind
it. He's got to finish his job.
Yeah. So he'll probably get some great big fat bonus when he's done. And he'll go to Credit Suisse or somewhere else. And he'll be just fine. But I will say that I think that from what I know about Jamie Dimon, I think that this will really, really change the internal way that J.P. Morgan monitors risk. I think he got a little bit complacent. I think he's really, really cross with himself. And so that J.P. Morgan, for clients who need some exposure to financial services, maybe one that they want to consider for a long-term hold.
Because it's cheaper now. Goodbye.
Yeah, because it's cheaper now, and because I think they're going to have significantly positive changes to the way they run the business.
Well, it's kind of like when we'll try to think of which jet liner when they had the crash. You remember which one it was down in the Everglades?
Yeah, AirTran.
AirTran, and they after the crash, obviously that was a horrible thing. People died, a lot of people, but after that, that was would have been one of the safest airlines to fly on because. They did what? They went in and they did all security checks and safety checks on all their planes.
Yeah.
So same thing with J.P. Morgan. So I think you're right, Scott, and I think that's something to take a look at.
Yeah. So we'll continue to monitor that. But, and we definitely have not heard the last of it. And the $2 billion number that's out there right now is more certainly going to go up. Yeah.
All right. Well, you mentioned I was going to do a good little segue here, so I'm going to do it anyway, artificially create it. You said Credit Suisse. I'm going to talk about Greece. Now.
All right.
we got to talk about Greece. Are they in the euro? Are they out the euro? Is it a matter of time? You know, we've been talking about this and saying, it probably won't happen. They'll work it out. The damage would be too great. And it's looking more and more like the expectations are. It's not a matter of if. Now it's a matter of when.
Well, I think the biggest challenge with the Greece situation is we don't really know what's going to happen. I think that's what really causes a lot of this sort of shakiness like we saw in the market on Wednesday. We really don't know what happened. So if you take a list of the biggest houses on Wall Street, Citigroup, J.P. Morgan, Royal Bank of Scotland, they all have a different analysis of what's going to happen. J.P. Morgan now says there's about a 50% chance of Greece leaving the euro. Up from about 20% that they had just about 6 months or so ago. Citigroup is saying that they think that the euro could trade at about $1.20, maybe even all the way down to $1.13 if they end up leaving. Danske Bank says that 54% of the Greek population supports staying in the EU program. 81% of it are in favor of staying with the EU with the euro currency, which is a different issue. So, you know, there's most of what I'm reading now says that this socialist government that is certainly to be swept into office in June is heavy in rhetoric now. But once they're in there, they're going to realize we really can't just sort of shut everything down, nationalize the banks, take the currency, go back to the drachma, and just kind of go on our own way. So I think they don't leave.
Okay. I'm going to bet they do. And I think they'll come out of the euro first, and then it'll come out of the union, and they'll just tell everybody, we're not paying you, we're done, and they'll go to the drachma, they'll devalue their currency, and they won't pay their debt, and they'll then just try to become very competitive with the pricing of their goods and services that they offer, and try to basically resurrect themselves, pull themselves up by their bootstraps.
Yeah, but I think at some point the ECB, the IMF, the European Troika, the Union Troika, whatever you want to call it, gets to the point that they make Greece a deal that's so good that they can't leave, because they know that if Greece leaves, Portugal leaves, Spain leaves, Italy leaves, Ireland leaves, and then it's...
Well, that was going to be the next question I was going to ask you, and you beat me to it, is who's next if Greece leaves? Then you've got it. Portugal.
Spain.
Ireland, Spain.
Yeah, those three. I think Portugal and Spain for sure. Ireland probably next on the list, and then Italy.
Italy, maybe.
Maybe.
Maybe. Okay. All right, well, let's go. We've got Greece nailed down. I've got a couple other things I want to talk to you about. We'll come back from the break, especially our portfolios and what you are doing, Scott, in managing the investment portfolios of Holland Financial clients, how we are dealing with these issues on a day-to-day basis. Stay tuned, ladies and gentlemen.
There are hundreds of annuities available in today's marketplace. How can you know if one is right for you? Certified financial planner David Holland answers this question and more in his educational booklet on annuities. To get your free copy, call Holland Financial at 888-747-PLAN. The annuity booklet provides a plain English explanation of the different types of annuities so you can decide if one is a good fit for your situation. Again, that number is 888-747-7526.
And we're back. I'm sure you missed us. Scott is in rare form today, enjoying every minute of his special guest appearance, taking the whole show.
I'm glad to not be home doing laundry and changing pull-ups.
Yeah, but you know what? I tell all the listeners when you're out that you are super dad for helping out.
If I was super dad that day.
Yeah, you were. How many pull-ups did you go through?
I ran out. I ran out. I had to call the wife and say, "We got to stop.
You got to make a stop. You got to make a diaper run."
Laundry detergent and pull-ups.
All right. Well, when the little guy's sick, that's what you got to do. Okay. Well, next up, I talked before the break. Talk about, for our listeners, and of course, many of our clients listen to the program as well. Talk a little bit about what we're doing with our investment portfolios, Scott, to deal with all of this, what I'll call junk.
Yeah, I'll tell you what we're doing, and then I'll tell you some alternative strategies that, you know, because you always have to have your, well, what is another idea?
What's your
here?
Plan B, yeah. Plan C?
Yeah, or even just what are other people doing? And we talk, you know, to a lot of folks that manage portfolios just to get an idea of what they're doing. And, you know, for us, we're asset allocators, which means that we have to maintain a certain exposure to international assets. So, for example, in our most aggressive portfolio, we keep about 30% international equity. That's our allocation there. In our most conservative portfolio, we keep about 5% international equity. Now, when I say international, that can be anything.
Yeah, that could be Brazil or it could be Greece.
Yeah. So one thing we have done is we've really, really, really reduced our European exposure almost to the lowest possible level that we can have and still maintain appropriate asset allocation models. So in our aggressive growth portfolio, only 3% of that portfolio is European equity. In conservative portfolio, a little over 1% is European equity. We're finding good exposure internationally in Canada, South America. Australia has been pretty good. So
we've rotated out of some of the hot spots or more difficult spots.
Yeah,
and
now,
into some other places.
Right. Now, our first focus, the way we manage portfolios, is risk. And now somebody who's a little bit more contrarian and somebody who is really return-focused rather than risk-focused might take the exact opposite approach. So
they might be plowing into Europe and other places saying, hey, there's an opportunity here.
Yeah, that's right. So, but we have made the conscious effort, and we've been doing it over the last 10 months or so, of rotating out of Europe. We're really at the very, very, very low end. And there are plenty of other international opportunities out there, so we don't need European exposure. So that's where we are right now. But some other ways that you can invest if you have to maintain international exposure, which you do as asset allocators, you can buy country-specific exchange-traded funds. You can buy just strictly Germany, or you can buy continent-specific. There's a lot of talk in the investing community about Africa right now.
Mm.
I'm not ready to do that with our portfolios because it sounds still very, very speculative. But there's a lot of talk about that out there. You can find exchange-traded funds and mutual funds who will invest X areas. So they'll say...
everything but.
Yeah, they'll say Asia X Japan, which means they're investing in all that part of Asia, but they're specifically avoiding Japan. So you can really, really target...
Pretty much anything you want, you can get.
Yeah, pretty much any... But the important thing is you have to maintain that broad diversification. Even if you have to hold your nose and do it, you have to have international exposure as an asset allocator.
Well, let's talk about that, because I think there are people that will say, well, Scott, if you know that things are going to be rough internationally, why don't you just repatriate, pull everything back to the United States? And your answer is, of course, risk.
Yeah, risk.
Because then, yeah, you're really doubling up on the United States.
Right. And there's a couple reasons for that. You want things that don't move in the same direction. You need low correlation, even negative correlation, so you're not really taking big, huge hits all at once. Sure, it does limit your upside potential, but, you know, we're not looking to be a home run hitter here and a strikeout batter. We're looking for singles and doubles and stuff like that. So that's the big thing. And then the other thing is that you just might be wrong. You know, when if you look just even a handful of months ago, at the end of September, it looked like the world was going to collapse. And then almost to a day on October 1st, things started to just plain old rally. You can't see them coming. You just have to sort of, you know, ride it out sometimes and just do the best you can to apply as much information and as much knowledge and experience as you can to put yourself in the best place.
And on that point, what do we say, or what would you say? And I think you just answered it, but I'll say it anyway. What do you say to the folks that say, well, you know, it's going to be, you know, USA Today had a quote from Rubini.
Yeah, Nouriel Roubini.
Yeah, he said basically the rest of the year it's going to be flat.
But that's the best prognosis Nouriel Roubini has ever given.
It's pretty negative.
Ooh.
So, but for folks out there that say, well, Scott, you know, it's going to be flat, so why wouldn't you just go to cash or go buy a 6-month bond or something and then, you know, see where we are?
Yeah, there's a bunch of reasons for that. First and foremost, because in our investment philosophy, we're investing for many years down the road, several years down the road.
Not just for the day.
Yeah, so candidly, what happened today, we were down 200 points and then ended up just about flat, is mostly irrelevant because we were looking at that stuff. And then also, just even if you look at this week, Monday was a really, really terrific day. And if we had been sitting in a cash position, we would have missed that entire day.
So look at it more weekly, monthly. Quarterly.
Yeah, you have to have a long-term view. I mean, for self-directed clients, what I have seen is that if you rebalance your portfolios more frequently than quarterly, you're probably doing yourself harm. If you're rebalancing your portfolios less frequently than semi-annually, you're probably doing yourself harm. But the other thing is that retail clients have a tendency to get these sort of manias, you know, and it's a different mania all the time. But a year ago, the mania was gold, right? Everybody you ran into said, I'm putting all my money into gold. I'll buy the physical gold. I'll find a way to buy it in my IRA. And look what's happened to gold. Look what happened to IPO. There was a mania around Facebook IPO. So you just have to
People were getting nutty about it and frustrated if they couldn't get it.
Yeah, so you have to be really careful. And those are really immediate examples. And the one that really strikes home for me is the gold example, because there were so many clients who said, everything's different now. It has to be gold. You have to get as much gold as you can. And look what's happened.
Well, what did it get to? What was the height? Was it 1900?
Just right at 1900. And we're down at 15 and change.
15 and change. I mean, that's a $400 drop. That's a 25% drop.
Yeah, in a year. And you know, which is okay if it's part of a allocated portfolio and you have other assets to offset that
risk.
Which
means you might only have a couple percent in gold.
Yeah, I would say for even the most aggressive, most bullish gold investor, commodities should be no more than maybe 10% of a portfolio.
Well, what's ironic is that, you know, you say for the most aggressive investor, and ironically, people that go to gold think they're being conservative.
Yeah, gold is so much more volatile than people realize. And what they say with commodities is that they climb a staircase, which is nice, but when they come down the elevator, which is not much fun. And that's what we've seen in gold really just in the last couple of weeks.
Well, we've got just a minute or two, Scott. Let's talk about the black gold, oil.
Yeah, oil has come down significantly. Now, that's kind of a double-edged sword. It's great for us. We fill up lower. It's easier for producers to ship. Plastic products, petroleum-based products are cheaper to produce. But part of the problem is that one of the reasons that we're seeing oil come down is because the producers are worried about
economic
slowdown. Yeah, so particularly in China, you know, which is a huge oil consumer.
Well, Lisa's flashing the 5-second warning, which means I'm actually out of time. I thought I had more time. See, that went fast. Thank you, Scott, for being with us on the program as always.
My pleasure.
And ladies and gentlemen, thank you for being with us. Stay tuned.
Want to learn more about Real Money with David Holland? Visit us at realmoneyradio.com, where you can listen live or to the archives. You can also email us your questions, comments, or show ideas to info@realmoneyradio.com. Be sure to like us on Facebook at Real Money with David Holland, and keep up with Scott Connor by following us on Twitter at Real Money Radio.
Real Money. Remember, nobody cares more about your money than you do. This has been Real Money with David Holland. Thank you for listening.